What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. Larry Rifkin along with John Kropczyk. And John, when you think of nine people dressed in black robes, what does that conjure up in your mind?
Is this a Halloween movie?
No. Well, not the red robes in Us, that new thriller with Jordan Peele. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about black robes.
Black robes. Oh, you got me stumped on this one.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, of course.
Yes, of course.
And our next guest, David Kaplan. Boy, what a great writer, reporter, and raconteur. I mean, he told us some incredible stories as part of this podcast. And he's somebody who has looked in at the Supreme Court for many years. He was long time with Newsweek. And this book that he's got, The Most Dangerous Branch. I mean, why do you think they're the most dangerous branch?
Well, I think they're really the people who are doing what the Congress should be doing is... You know, Congress is passing laws and they're really dictating if they're good laws or if they're bad laws. And, you know, I blame Congress. Congress should be doing a better job at what they're doing.
Well, he'll talk about
that. They're asleep at the wheel.
And he tells us in many ways that the Supreme Court often issues rulings that run against popular opinion, and, you know, that is part of what it is they're there to do. But he thinks that they're kind of sticking their noses into certain things that perhaps they shouldn't. And the court lacks some humility in the way they go about their business. Well, think about it, John. How humble would you be if a president nominated you for a lifetime appointment to the most prestigious place, the most insulated institution in the world? That's why some of the stuff that he talks about in the podcast and the book is so remarkable, because he's not just talking about the workings of the court in a very formalistic way. He's also talking about the personalities.
Right.
And there
right.
are personalities.
There are personalities, without a doubt. And let's face it, we all come to the table with biases, too. So.
Oh, absolutely they do. And today, the U.S. Supreme Court and decisions related to it have become one of the biggest part of our presidential elections. Well, I am going to nominate somebody who's a strict constructionist or somebody who likes the court to be more organic in its thinking. So it really has become a big part of the political dialogue in America these days. But this guy is so tremendous. And I know we took a little bit longer than we normally do on our podcast because he was so entertaining. You're going to love this, and you're going to learn a whole lot today on America Trends from David Kaplan. All right, join us, The Most Dangerous Branch. With us on the line is David Kaplan. The book, The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. And David, obviously, titles for books are meant to get our attention. But what kind of assault on the Constitution is taking place at the highest court of the land?
Well, you know, you wrestle with titles and subtitles all the time. And the title on this book, Random House and I thought were great early on. But we wrestled over the subtitle and should it be Undermine the Constitution, Betray the Constitution, Assaulted, Undermine Look Too Long. So the point of the book is that I argue that for the last 50 or so years, the court has overreached, has been overly assertive, overly aggressive. That's not a liberal position. That's not a conservative position. And the book has annoyed or infuriated liberals and conservatives alike. But I argue that the consequences of that court overreach are profound.
And what are they?
Well, I'd list four things. One, it helps to enfeeble Congress. Congress does a lousy job for any number of reasons. First, you know, it's full of a lot of chuckleheads, for lack of a better term.
That's a technical term, well, isn't it?
That's also something you probably wouldn't put in a subtitle. But because congressmen and senators know that the court so often is going to have the last word on voting rights, gun control, and so forth, the legislators don't want to stick their necks out. It's not worth the political capital. You can't argue that's the sole cause of congressional ineptitude, but I would argue that one of the reasons for congressional timidity and incompetence is the court. Second, it helps produce, it distorts presidential elections. In 2016, a quarter of Trump voters said they pretty much couldn't stand him and or his policies, but voted for him because of the kind of nominee they thought he would put on the court. And they were correct. They got the kind of nominees they wanted. About 20% of Clinton voters, according to exit polls, so they didn't have much regard for her, but they liked who they thought she'd put on the Supreme Court. And for the court to have such an overriding importance, even compared with a whole lot of other pressing issues, seems to me to be a bad thing. It distorts confirmation hearings. One of the reasons the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings became the circus they did is because a single seat on the court can be so important, all the more so when it looks like he's going to be the deciding vote. And I think ultimately it's bad for the court. The court has no actual power. It doesn't control armies. It doesn't control the purse in the way Congress does. Its power derives from its prestige. Other branches listen to it because it has a kind of legitimacy that the other branches don't. And when the court steps in too often, then it's capital for the kinds of historic steps it took, for example, in Brown against Board of Education, desegregating public schools in 1954, and that capital is lessened. So for all four of those reasons, I think the court's overreach is profound and has gotten worse. And I mark the beginning of that period as Roe v. Wade in the early 1970s, but you could mark it at different points. Again, it's not a liberal position and it's not a conservative position. It's a position about the court's power, but it has proven to be a difficult argument to make because people too often confuse a position in a particular policy dispute with whether the court ought to be the one be resolving that dispute. So if you're in favor of liberal abortion rights, you tend to think, obviously, that Roe v. Wade's a good decision. And if you're pro-life, as the term has come to be known, I don't much like the label, then you think Roe v. Wade is bad. If you like Republican presidents, you think Bush v. Gore awarding the presidency to George W. Bush in 2000 was a good decision. And if you don't like George W. Bush, then you think it's a bad decision. But that ought not be the basis on which we evaluate Supreme Court decisions. And it should not be that difficult to say, I strongly believe in this or that policy position. I just don't think that victory ought to be achieved at the Supreme Court. And for me, for example, I happen to believe in extremely liberal abortion policies. But I also think the court is not the place to be where such rights ought to be won. Not every good policy, not every right is a constitutional one.
So let's go back to the start, and let's go back to Brutus, this critic of the proposed Constitution back in 1788, writing that he warned the court would dominate Congress and the states by imposing the justice's own sense of the Constitution. And then you had Alexander Hamilton writing under an assumed name, saying that the judiciary may truly be said to have neither force nor will, but merely judgment. The court will always be, he stated, the least dangerous to the political rights of the Constitution. So what happened here?
Well, you know, and of course the title, The Most Dangerous Branch, is a play on Hamilton, back of the Federalist, at the time of the founding, calling the court the least dangerous branch. Well, what happened is that with big exceptions like Dred Scott, the ruling just before the Civil War, which helped to create the Civil War by declaring the Missouri Compromise unconstitutional and by declaring that slaves were mere property, for the most part, the court stayed out of big ticket disputes and was not particularly aggressive until the early 20th century. And then the court started to intervene. In the early 20th century, it was a very conservative court and was striking down all kinds of legislation on the alleged grounds of economic freedom. So if a state passed minimum wage laws or maximum hour laws or other workplace safety legislation, the court decided over the course of several decades that such legislation was unconstitutional because it deprived Americans of economic liberty. And during FDR's first term, FDR pushed back against a lot of New Deal legislation being struck down by the Supreme Court, ultimately threatened court packing, right. And the court, for a variety of reasons, switched gears. It was the switch in nine. It was a switch in time that saved nine, as one WAG put it, switch in the nine justices. And then the court upheld economic legislation most of the time, as it has largely done ever since. Very close case in Obamacare and some others, but it was in the area of personal liberty that the court began to strike down legislation. They said that individual liberty, for example, in cases like abortion, precluded legislatures from making any number of substantive policy decisions. Why did the court become aggressive in the 20th century? Beyond the scope of my book, beyond the scope of our podcast discussion, but largely because of membership changes in the court, because at times of the slowness or ineffectiveness or other branches, and also because the Constitution is quite vague on what the powers of the justices are. And at a certain level, you see what you can get away with. The great William Brennan, a Supreme Court justice from 1956 until 1990, by anybody's account, one of the great justices in Supreme Court history in terms of ability to get stuff done, and was the liberal lion for more than a generation. He would say, and he said it to me once in conversation late in his tenure, he would hold up five fingers, and he would hold up each finger sequentially and say, with five votes, you can do anything around here. And it's funny, but not so much.
The founding fathers, I mean, when they thought about it, and the fact that we were going to give this lifetime tenure to these nine justices, and that things were going to get perhaps over time much more complex as they have, and we've had, as you called it, an enfeebled Congress and a litigious society and lots of regulatory underpinning now that goes with every broad sweeping piece of legislation. I mean, could anybody have envisioned, we thought they were so forward thinking, could they have envisioned that this might be the case?
Well, it's hard. First of all, they didn't envision nine justices because the Constitution doesn't set up the number of justices there'll be on the court. That number is set by Congress. And we can talk about court packing because there's nothing unconstitutional about it. And I've come around to the position since I finished my book that the Democrats ought to seriously follow through on what only a few now talk about publicly, that if they take control of both houses of Congress and win the presidency next year, then in 2021, they ought to seriously consider packing the court to undo what happened with Merrick Garland not even getting a hearing and Neil Gorsuch making it to the court. I think in the short term, that'll be disastrous for the court. But sometimes you have to burn down the institution to rebuild it. To your question specifically, I don't think most of the founders or the drafters would have envisioned what the court has become. They wouldn't necessarily have envisioned what it became in the near term. Remember that the great Chief Justice John Marshall, one of the early chief justices who served for more than three decades, created the power for the court of judicial review, the idea that the Supreme Court could strike down an act of Congress as unconstitutional. That is not in the Constitution. It's hardly obvious from the Constitution, but Marshall invented that power, one of the great power grabs in American history. Now, it's probably correct. It's probably a good idea. In order for the court to have any power, it has to be the last word on determining whether a statute or a regulation is constitutional. But it's not obvious, and there is some, you know, scholarly debate on whether that decision is actually correct. But nobody seriously questions.
Well, where do you go to challenge? Where do you go to challenge that?
Well, ultimately, it may be that each branch, that the executive branch or the legislative branch, is the ultimate determinant of constitutionality, subject, of course, to the will of the people. You know, at some level, constitutionality is ultimately the will of the people. And one of the great lessons in studying American constitutional law is the court rarely is out of step with public opinion for very long. It is often said, and probably correctly, that the Supreme Court follows the election returns. Sometimes it leads. It was out front, certainly, in Brown against the Board of Education. It was out front, maybe, in the case of abortion. But look at a case like same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. When the Supreme Court in 2015 said same-sex marriage was constitutional right, which I think on the merits is probably correct, they by and large had laid back for almost a decade, while state legislatures, lower federal courts, some state courts had begun finding there was such a right. The Supreme Court, for all the credit it legitimately gets in cases like Brown against the Board of Education, is a conservative institution, conservative with a small c.
When we look at where we are today, we just did a podcast taping with Julian Zelizer from Princeton on his book Fault Lines. And so here we are at a point with great division in our country. And many of us, I think, look at the Supreme Court today and the confirmation hearings and the way that the president defines, you know, you're going to be my guy on the court. And of course, I know Justice Roberts, it was unprecedented for him to respond to that saying, I'm not a Trump judge, I'm not of this, I'm not of that.
But it wasn't unprecedented, but it is certainly unusual for the Chief Justice of the United States to push back on what he hears in the political sphere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But many of us think it's now a political debating society, as opposed to this from a remove, a judicial oversight of the highest order. Why do we look at
it is certainly politicized now. You have, for the first time, the situation where the justices who were appointed by Democrats vote one way, and the justices appointed by Republican presidents vote the other way. The court takes on the appearance of just being a proxy for political patrons, and it wasn't always like that. Remember, Gerald Ford nominated John Paul Stevens, who turned out to be the liberal leader of the court, for example, in the 90s, and until he retired in 2010. David Souter, appointed by the first George Bush, was quite liberal. Byron White, appointed by JFK, was quite conservative. You couldn't always predict who appointed him. Sandra Day O'Connor was more middle of the road than Ronald Reagan ever imagined. That's changed. Having said that, the court has been heavily politicized at other times. For example, during the 1930s and early 1940s, as I mentioned, during FDR's term. The problem now is that with congressional ineffectiveness and torpor, the court on so many issues runs the country, and as I wrote in the book and as others have said, you know, when it was a 5-4 court on so many key issues, Justice Kennedy, now retired, ran the country. In some respects, that person who runs the country is now going to be Chief Justice Roberts. He's the swing vote. Don't mistake him to be a moderate, but he's what passes for the middle of the court. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg left the court, that, you know, Brett Kavanaugh would be what passes for the center. I argue in the book that I think the best hope for the court institutionally is probably Roberts. Roberts has a regard for history and a respect for the institution that may, in some instances, trump, no pun intended, his own decidedly conservative instincts. You saw that take place in 2012 in the first Obamacare ruling. Would I place great hope in Chief Justice Roberts truly becoming a small C conservative? No, but I think it's possible. He is certainly whip smart, probably, if not the smartest member of the court, one of the two or three smartest. So I'm not entirely pessimistic, but mostly so. The problem is, and I interviewed a majority of the justices.
Well, first of all, your book is remarkable because you did interview so many people, a majority of the current justices, past justices, 65 law clerks who've worked at the court. I mean, a remarkable body of work that went into this. So give us your insights. Yes.
Well, I had 2 years to work on the book. I lucked out. I'm all of those interviews helped inform, I think, where the book comes out. But what was I did all those interviews are done on background, so I can't tell you which justices I talked to. But among the things that came through from talking to them, you know, was this view of we're the grown-ups in government. They would look at point out the window, either at Congress or down the street toward the White House, and say, listen, somebody's got to be responsible. And while, of course, that's correct, you can't be particularly impressed, you know, with the current occupant of the White House or what happens or doesn't happen in Congress. But I was struck by how that view was held by justices on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, my view is I don't have much regard for democracy. It's not a great system. Winston Churchill was correct. There's just no better system. And in the long run, I'll place my lot with what democracy produces. That's better than trusting 9 unelected, unaccountable judges. And unless somebody wants to make me the monarch and let me decide everything, which would be fine, I don't have a better system. And I'm not sure that the Constitution itself or its drafters envisioned anything else. Of course, the Supreme Court has to step in plenty of instances. The Supreme Court is a check on majorities. It is a counter-majoritarian institution. And there are parts of the Constitution that obviously call out to the justices to put a brake on what the majority wants. The First Amendment, protection of freedom of expression, is designed to protect minority expression. Majorities don't need protection. But if you want to burn the flag, or if you want to be a communist or a white supremacist, if you want to speak such views, not take action, but if you want to speak such heretical views, you need a First Amendment to protect you. If you're a criminal defendant and you want to be protected against unreasonable searches and seizures or cruel and unusual punishment or not be tortured to confess, you need the 4th, 5th, and 8th Amendments to the Constitution. And only a court, only the Supreme Court is going to vindicate those interests. So I don't argue in the book for an impotent Supreme Court. It is legitimately called the most powerful court in the history of the world. I just think the court ought to be more restrained in a whole lot of areas, as I argue in the book, whether it's abortion on the left, or voting rights, or gun control, or campaign finance. The court ought to be more reluctant to step in and more deferential to the elected branches of government.
The highly engaging and very informed David Kaplan is on with us. The book is called The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. What about the imperial presidency, which both parties have embraced? I mean, isn't that outsized as well today? And how does the outsized presidency relate to the dangerous court?
That's a great question. And sure, in the modern era, the executive has become far more powerful than anybody could have imagined 100 years ago. Some of that has to do with the exigencies of nuclear war, of air power. You've got to have a president who can act quickly. Nothing wrong with that. And all the agencies of the federal government, the administrative state, as the Trumpers call it, you're necessarily put in these agents, OSHA, the SEC, the EPA, the FDA, and so forth. They're going to have great power. And the court sometimes tries to put a brake on that. Remember during George W. Bush's time, during the height of the Iraq War, the court correctly pushed back on Bush and Cheney's assertion of vast power to treat American citizens as well as non-citizens in a way that seemed to violate the Constitution. So I don't have any problem with that at all. But in many cases, and it probably in the travel ban case, although I think that's a tricky case. I'm sort of 51-49 on that case. The travel ban case, I think to the extent that Congress gave the president vast power on immigration policy and control of the borders, well, that's Congress's decision. And I think the court probably in the travel ban case probably issued the correct decision. It's trickier because it bucks up against religious freedom issues. And, you know, again, if you don't like what Congress does or doesn't do, there's a solution. Get out and vote. It's why I really have relatively little sympathy for those who argue about prevalence of big money in politics. I don't like big money in politics. I abhor it. I think it's terrible. But ultimately, if you and I vote for the candidate who puts the most ads on during the Super Bowl, you and I are both idiots. We're irresponsible. If we can't spend the time all the more in this digital age where it's so easy to get information, not so easy to distill it, to figure out facts from fiction. But if you and I can't do a little bit of homework to decide which candidates to vote for in local elections or the presidential election and are simply captive to who put on the most ads, whoever had the most money, then we sort of deserve the government we get. Now, I ultimately think that Congress ought to be able to pass legislation limiting big money. I think the Citizens United case, you know, on regulating money and I would give Congress that power, whether I agree with the statute or not. I don't think that money is the equivalent of speech. My only point is that I think it's a closer case than people grant. But I ultimately think that, you know, you get the government that you deserve. There are all sorts of flaws in the system. The Electoral College is probably outdated. It's never going to change. But if you don't like what your elected representatives are doing, choose new elected representatives.
Let's look at the Supreme Court in terms of what it does decide on, which cases it determines really justify their scrutiny. Because we have the circuit courts, we have the appellate courts, and I know they're being remade by President Trump and the Federalist Society and others. So tell us where the action is in the courts and how much action ends up at the Supreme Court and how they decide to take on a case.
Well, the federal trial courts, called the district courts, and then the intermediate federal appellate courts, called the circuit courts, they pretty much have to take cases. But the Supreme Court, for the most part, determines its own docket. They have to take virtually no case. There are a few areas, we don't need to get into it, where they're required to hear the case. But for the most part, they alone decide which cases they get. And they're asked 7,000 or 8,000 times a year to take a case. They wound up hearing 60 to 80 cases a year in recent years. Used to be 150, 200, but that's changed. They take a tiny percentage of their cases, so they can largely dictate, you know, where they're going to affect the law. What does it take to get the justices to grant your case?
Yeah.
It takes 4 votes, not even a majority of the court. 4 votes gets the court on the docket. How do justices decide? It's a black box at the Supreme Court. Most justices don't talk about it. They don't write about it a whole lot. The most common area where they'll take a case is where there is a split, a division in the lower federal courts. If different circuits are reaching different conclusions, because they're not bound by each other, then the Supreme Court will often take that case. And that's why you'll often see them taking boring tax or security or labor law questions that nobody much cares about. But in hot-button areas, like we've talked about, abortion, gun control, they'll take cases because they think they're interesting, because they know there's public agitation about it. And I argue in the book there are a lot of areas where they ought not take cases. I think Roe v. Wade in 1973 was best not taken by the court. Maybe they could have ruled far more narrowly, as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and others have argued, but I think they might have done better to not hear that case at all then. In the same way, I argue in the book that while I think they were correct in Obergefell, the same-sex marriage case in 2015, mm-hmm. they might have been better off institutionally laying back. Don't take the case. Let the lower federal courts and legislatures continue to deal with the issue. Lay back. It might have been a great example of court restraint in saving its power for other cases. And of course, the signal case of our time where the court should have stayed out is Bush v. Gore in 2000, where you had a disputed presidential election. You essentially had a tie. You had Florida, the deciding state, the votes separated by a few hundred, the candidates separated by a few hundred votes. And in that signal case, the court could have done the statesman-like thing and said, we're not going to hear the case, go across the street. Because, of course, the Constitution sets up explicitly what to do in the case of a disputed presidential election. The House and the Senate decide. And the court simply couldn't resist. You know, we do because we can, not because we should. But there were enough votes to take the case. And it did tragic damage to the court. Bush v. Gore haunts that institution. They don't want to talk about it, but the one question, maybe apart from Roe v. Wade, that I couldn't get most of the justices to talk about much was Bush v. Gore. It doesn't get mentioned.
Interesting.
Day in and day out, month in and month out. But they understand that at some institutional level, not at the popular political level, you don't hear it debated in Congress, you don't hear it mentioned in presidential elections, but they all recognize that that was a self-inflicted wound that may take them a generation or two ultimately to get over.
David, take us into that black box one more time. How lofty are their deliberations? I mean, or how plebeian are they in terms of how they go back and forth?
Well, they don't really deliberate much. I mean, it's always striking to be reminded that it's not a debating side. When they go into their conference, as it's called, the big conference room in the Chief Justice's chambers, which only the nine justices...
Do they wear black robes at that time?
No, they wear suits or they wear their business attire.
Okay.
And they don't... This Chief Justice, more than chiefs in the past, allows a little more discussion. But you at most are going to get 5 minutes, at the most, to talk about how you're going to vote in the case we just heard in the courtroom, and on decisions about whether to take a case, there's virtually no discussion at all. It is not a debating society. And to the extent they do discuss cases with each other and try to persuade each other, you might drop into my chambers for a chat, but more likely you'll put it in a memo. That's great for history because there'll be a paper record, but the court really operates as sort of nine small separate law firms. There isn't a whole lot of discussion. Scalia would rant about such things because he, the law professor, loved to debate, and the court wasn't willing to do that. It's part of it is they're busy. They don't have time. I also will tell you that while their opinions sometimes read as polemics, I think they really do try most of the time to act as judges. They do not view themselves as politicians. They try to separate their partisan views from their judging views. Scalia was really bad at it. The great Thurgood Marshall a generation ago was really bad at it. But I think they try to perform the role of the judge as you and I and anyone else would hope they should. The question, though, of course, isn't their intent. It's whether they successfully do so. And as I argue in the book, they don't. It's really hard not to use it.
You have them under the cloak of anonymity in this book, the many that you talk to. What do they think about us? And what do they think about the people that we elect in general and the way the deliberations go on in Congress or don't at this moment?
Well, I think they reflect the system, but I don't think they have much regard for you. Read their decision. I mean, their contempt for Congress. It's palpable from both sides of the aisle. I mean, listen, it's hard writing legislation. You got 435 people in the House, and you got 100. And it's a big, unruly institution. So, of course, it's going to be messy. You know, Bismarck, nobody wants to see how legislation and sausage are made. But I also think, depending on which side of the aisle you're talking about and which particular dispute, they don't have much regard for the president either. I'm not just talking about Trump, although I'm certainly talking about Trump. I think some of them didn't necessarily have a whole lot of regard for his predecessor. They're a pretty arrogant bunch. Part of that is they're a really smart bunch, really smart. Almost every single one of them, in my view, not every one of them, but almost every single one of them is pretty damn smart.
Well, by the way, and dish for us, because you do have some very, you know, certain feelings about the people on the court. I mean, who's the smartest and who's the least intelligent?
Well, I love my justices equally like my children. So, no, I, you know, who do I think smartest on the court? The Chief Justice, Elena Kagan, but Breyer, and don't mistake Breyer or Ginsburg, or for that matter, Kavanaugh, for being lightweights. I think Kennedy, now retired, was not the sharpest knife in the draw. I don't think Clarence Thomas was. But all told, in comparison to some, maybe some past courts, it's a very bright bunch. And for the most part, it's a collegial bunch. They all, for the most part, like each other. You know, Scalia and Ginsburg, political opposites, judicial opposites,
yeah,
were famous friends. They went to the opera together. They celebrated holidays together. There are times when the court, where they really talked to each other, nine scorpions in a bottle, they were famously called during parts of FDR's time. Not so much on this court. I don't have a whole lot of information, because it's after the book was written, about how Kavanaugh fits in. I think structurally, they clearly were unhappy that the court was put in the center of the storm. His performance was not so good. But, you know, most of them knew Kavanaugh. Elena Kagan, when she was dean of Harvard Law School, hired Kavanaugh to do some part-time teaching. Gorsuch and Kavanaugh both clerked, I think, a year apart for Kennedy.
What about Gorsuch?
I put in the book that there's a joke around the court that when Gorsuch came, you know, 2 years ago, he did the impossible. He succeeded in unifying the court. How did he do that? Everybody hated him, you know. And
the Ted Cruz of the court.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a great analogy. I'm not sure it's that extreme, but he came in, you know, guns a-blazing, and showing how smart he was, and he didn't really lay back the way you're supposed to. He talked a lot in oral argument. He wrote a lot of dissents, even in cases where the court decided not to hear a case. And I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And I describe at some length in the book some of, you know, the pissing contests between him and the Chief Justice, and how the Chief periodically would put him down. And, you know, if you're going to get into a pissing contest with somebody, the Chief Justice is probably not the right guy. He's smart, and he's funny, and he's quick, and he's glib. And also, if I forgot to mention, he's the Chief. So Gorsuch probably didn't do him a whole lot of good.
Yeah, and if you're a cameraman listening to this, don't shoot him from behind, because you'll show the bald spot, and he won't like that. In closing,
well, you know, they're just human beings. They live in a marble temple. They wear black robes. They have great titles. But, you know, ultimately, they're just people. So Gorsuch blew off the first private conference that he was eligible to go to a few days after his confirmation. He did it because he said that he wasn't up to speed on the cases. He also promised to take his oldest daughter on a college tour. And the Chief Justice said to him, you know, that's going to look bad. The wise guys in the press are going to get hold of it. You can't not come to your first conference, and Gorsuch still doesn't come. Sort of not real bright on Gorsuch's part, but again, you know, the example you just mentioned. Around the court, it is said that there's a rule. To the extent the court can control placement of cameras on the rare times that the justices are photographed, don't photograph the Chief Justice from behind. He doesn't like it. Why? Because he has a bald spot. And it's interesting. After the book came out, I was sitting down with one of the justices, just socially. And the justice I have to be careful of gender here, will go with their hand on my shoulder and said, I want you to know, the Chief Justice wants you to know that he's read your book, pause, paws, and he does not have a bald spot. And I said, yeah. And, you know, Trump's inaugural crowd was bigger than Obama's. I have the photographic evidence. He does have a bald spot. And why is that the one thing he noticed in the book? And why is he telling you? And the justice sort of just smiled and said, I'm just passing along to you what the chief wanted you to know. There's a certain amount of vanity in that, like, obviously, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They're just people.
David, we could go on forever, but we have to end this. And we want to ask you, since we look at social and political trends in the country, what is it that we can do? You talk about a single 18-year term. What are the reforms we can make going forward or should look at as it relates? You talked about packing the court. Realistically, what do you think we should be looking at?
Oh, realistically, so clicking my heels three times and saying I'm back in Kansas, that won't work. Yeah, well, there's a lot of talk about term limits, but the justices have life tenure as granted by the Constitution. An 18-year term limit would make great sense. We'd no longer look to appoint young justices. You know, Roberts was 50 when he was named. Gorsuch was 50. At a certain point, we're going to start trying to nominate people right after their bar mitzvah. That's not good for the court. And there are a lot of qualified, talented 65-year-olds, all the more so in an age when people live longer, who are effectively disqualified because we're trying to appoint young people. The 18-year term would make great sense. It would depoliticize the process. Eventually, once we cycled it in, once there were retirements in a generation or two, each president then would get two appointments. But it will never happen because the party, if you will, in power, will never agree to it. Court packing, however, doesn't require a constitutional amendment in the way that getting rid of life tenure would be. All it requires is an act of Congress and a bill signed by the president. As I mentioned before, I think, and I'm one of only very few who will say so, that the Democrats, if they take control in January 2021, ought to seriously consider packing the court. It will be vilified. It'll be criticized just as it was in 1937 when FDR proposed it. Back then, it was dead on arrival. But things are so politicized now. The partisanship is so crazed that I think there's a substantial chance that kind of thing might get through. I think that would be bad for the court. And, of course, then the Republicans would be chomping at the bit. When they take control in 2025 or 2029 to pack the court some more. Maybe it shouldn't be, you know, it's now nine justices. If the Democrats put two seats on the court to make it 11 and thereby take back control, are the Republicans going to want to add two more seats? After that, I mean, at a certain point, you're going to need a bigger building. And at a certain point, it becomes absurd. My hope would be, because ultimately, to me, it's not about quote unquote control of the court. It's about both sides recognizing that you got to disarm. You have to start treating the court differently. So if I supported court packing, it wouldn't be for political reasons. It would be for institutional reasons that maybe at some point, Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives all agree this has to stop. But it's a big but. In the end, it's not about what the politicians do. In the end, it's what the justices do. And as I argue in the book, the problem of the court, if you believe there is a problem, begins at home. The justices created this problem. And you can lament, as I do and you might, how it distorts presidential elections, for example, and how Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and the candidates next year similarly will make the court a gigantic issue. And all of that is terrible. But in the first instance, it's because of how the justices themselves behave. You know, when I discussed that with justices, I got some, you know, a little bit of acknowledgement that, yeah, at a certain level, David, that's true. Pause, next paragraph. But what do you expect us to do? And I think for the most part, most of the justices, most of the time, on both sides of the aisle, don't have a big problem with their interventions. They just disagree with which cases they should intervene in. You know, when the justices would ask me at the beginning of a conversation to sort of summarize the point in my book, because it's not like they've studied why I've come in. They've agreed to talk to me, either because they got my letter, or we had a brief phone call, or through email. But they want me to sort of refresh what the book's about. So I explain the court's too aggressive, the court's too assertive, the court is overreached. And I had one liberal justice and one conservative justice each say to me in response to that summary with a smile, I half agree with you. That's the problem. They, of course, they believe in a more restrained court and a more deferential court and a more minimalist court.
Not on their
just
issues.
Just in these cases, and they disagree on which cases it is. You know, what's activism? Activism is what the other guy does. But they need to look at home, and they need to look inward and sometimes ask themselves a lot more often, ought we do best to just stay out? And you know, we've talked about history. There are some big cases on the horizon this year. They're currently deciding. I haven't even looked this afternoon to see what they did. There's an abortion case coming up to them to block what a lower court outrageously has done in the area of abortion. There's a major gun control case they'll hear in the fall. And there's a big partisan gerrymandering case in the spring. The problem is, in my view, for example, is they're going to intervene again in a Second Amendment case when they should not. They're not going to defer to what a local legislature has done. And they're not going to intervene in partisan gerrymandering. To me, the one area where the court ought to be aggressive and ought to be getting rid of the distortion of elections, You can't expect legislatures to regulate themselves. The ins are going to always try to keep themselves in power and keep the outs out. In the classic area where the court ought to get involved, the court has said for decades, not our job. So I think the courts got it all wrong. They don't intervene when they should, and they intervene when they shouldn't. Apart from that, everything's great.
Having said that, David Kaplan, it's pretty remarkable, given what the Republicans did with the 2010 census, that they were toppled by 40 seats this time. It was never meant to be that way. You talk about the public really responding. There should have been no way the Democrats took control of the House of Representatives until another census. But that's for another day.
It's a fair question, but at a certain point, you can't put all the Democrats, you can't put all the liberals into one district. At a certain point, there are going to be enough Democrats in a liberal state or enough Republicans in a conservative state that they're going to get some seats. The problem is, and if you look at the statistics, there are states, for example, like Wisconsin, dominated by Republican legislature.
Ohio.
Where less than 50% of the vote yielded, you know, 60% of the seats or 52%. It's a terrible situation where only an unelected body of government, judges, are going to solve the problem. It is so obviously an area for intervention, and the court has intervened in racial gerrymandering. It outlawed racial gerrymandering decades ago, but it has resisted getting involved.
No, I agree with you, David. I was just pointing out it was pretty remarkable what the people did on their own, because it seemed improbable at best that this House of Representatives could turn, given the way it's been gerrymandered. But having said that, this has been an incredible conversation. I've loved every minute of it. David Kaplan, The Most Dangerous Branch, Inside the Supreme Court's Assault on the Constitution. Thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
My pleasure.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.